shares, market, the S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that wishes you a very happy Easter. That's right, I'm Scott Easter Bunny Phillips, and with me is...
What can I call you?
Maybe you can just call me Easter Bunny Bunny something.
That'll do. Easter Bunny Bunny, Doc.
And Nirvan Mahanti. G'day, Doc. How are you?
I'm very good.
Mate, happy Easter. We are recording this, as I mentioned, last week. We recorded this last week, so that's kind of weird, but happy Easter, mate.
Happy Easter to all our listeners.
Exactly. We hope you have a great break. For those of you who are religiously minded, we hope Easter is a enjoyable and fulfilling time for you. And for those who aren't, we hope you're having a good break, getting a chance to kick back a little bit, spend some time with family and friends, or just simply
eating chocolate.
Eating chocolate, exactly. What are you a chocolate eater?
No, I mean, the fridge gets filled with Easter chocolates. And my daughter this morning actually took a bag, and she said, "That bag is too small." So I said, "Look at your stuff, your Easter eggs this much, so I'm going to get a lot more." So, well, okay, well, good luck, mate.
Very nice. It's a good time of year, mate. I'm actually off chocolate. I've been off chocolate since last June. So it's going to kill me to go through Easter without having any chocolate, but I'm a Cadbury chocolate fan, generally speaking.
Okay.
Well, I can still taste it.
Well, you just have to avoid the craving, well, and I wish you luck.
Yeah. Well, there's no chocolate in the house yet, so fingers crossed. I know my mother has a well-worn Easter tradition, which is she buys the eggs early and then eats them, and then buys some more and eats those, and then buys some more, and then they're normally the ones we get. So the grandkids will be well looked after, but there will be the third or fourth generation of eggs that enter her house that end up being given to the kids. Mate, we have a chock full mailbag this week. We are recording this a week earlier, as I mentioned, so we recorded this a week ago, and so we don't have anything particularly timely. If any great news broke this week, then we know about it. We just can't tell you about it because we've already recorded the podcast. We will instead concentrate on the mailbag. I think, look, we think based on the feedback that we get from you, this is an enjoyable part of what we do. We also hope that we can cover some important investing concepts in answering your questions, and as always, as we say, if you do want to get in contact with us, please hit us up on email, on Facebook, or on Twitter, and I'll give those handles a little bit later. But we do love hearing from you, as I mentioned, most weeks. It's great to know what's on your mind, to understand the questions that you have to ask, and give us a chance to answer things that we think are important to you, or at least you're telling us are important to you. Mate, that's about enough of an intro. Should I get on with it?
Yes, let's do it.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Now, I've set a horrible task for myself because, Doc, last week, I almost certainly mispronounced Valhav's name.
Let me do it.
Can you do it? Can you do it?
So it's Vaibhav.
Oh, jeez. I'm glad you're
doing it. Mehrotra.
Oh, man. Is now, it an Indian name?
It looks like an Indian name. And
can you go again for me?
Vaibhav Mehrotra.
Oh, God. I'm glad I didn't have to do that. Thank you, mate.
You should try.
No.
I love putting in a spot. You had a great.
I was watching you pronounce a thing. I'm glad I don't have to do that. I can't. You can't.
You had a great segue with the chalk and the chocolate. You know, I thought you can do very well as well.
I would love to. I look. I know. I don't say it with any fun. I don't. It's not something I do to try and make fun of people's names. And I have absolutely no intention of doing so.
Just going to give me a like on Twitter.
That's got to be worth something, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Anirban Mahanti is Doc's Twitter account. Do that. Do that for me, please. I do apologize for horribly mispronouncing it, mate. And thank you for not correcting me until this week. It makes me a little bit less bad, but my apologies. It's not something I like doing. I try and get it right where I can. All right. So the second half of the question from last week from
Vaibhav,
thank you, is I'm new to Superstaff. Sorry, any drawbacks on switching super funds? I'm new to Superstaff and with Rest at the moment. Not sure if I should be happy with the performance since 2015. Now, that's a really, really good question. I'm going to give a general thought, but before I do, Doc, your thoughts on whether it's advisable, or are there any drawbacks in switching super funds?
Okay, this is a very complex question.
Isn't it?
It's a complex question.
That's why I asked you, mate.
It's a great question.
I do the simple ones. Like, I ask you the hard ones.
This is a complex question. So, there's no drawback as such to switch your super fund in the sense that, if you can find a better performing super fund, then why not, right?
Yep.
The government regulations make it easy to actually switch the funds. The many considerations here, right? You have to see what the performance of the Rest fund is. You have to see, how the allocations, a lot of the performance also depends on how you have asked your fund to allocate your money, right? So that's,
So if you haven't asked them, you're normally in what's called a My Super product, where they give you a sort of a balanced
portfolio.
Investment strategy.
Yeah.
Which probably got some cash, some property, some overseas shares, some local shares.
Exactly.
Or you can say, hey, I'm a super conservative investor. I just want to be in cash. Or I'm a super aggressive investor. I want to be in high growth.
Yeah.
And so they're going to kind of, it's hard to blame the fund if you haven't chosen how you want
exactly,
the money invested.
Exactly.
Right?
And there are other things, like, you know, super funds would also have life insurance products inbuilt into them. Point. So you have to look into that.
Yep.
Super is a, it's a complex. It's really, really complex. And
sounds like something invented by a government, mate.
Seems like, well, it's a good product, actually. It's a wonderful thing in the long run, but that it is a complex product.
I agree.
So, I mean, I'll leave it to you to come up with, like,
handball.
Yeah, hand the ball back to you. In all the sense that there is no, I mean, there are lots of things you can look at, a lot of variables here to look at, but you know. It's just a hard one.
Mate, I'm glad you talked about the investment strategies because it wasn't something I was going to talk about. So I'm glad you mentioned it. Otherwise, it would have gone untouched. And that's why I have you here because you're the guru and I just talk about stuff. My view generally is a couple things. So firstly, I think the strategy thing is super, super important. And while we won't give specific advice because we can't at all in this podcast ever, but in general in this circumstance, as a matter of course, the first thing is shares are volatile, right? Investing is volatile. Property is volatile. We know it wasn't supposed to be, and all of a sudden now it is. At least we always knew it was, but some people didn't know it was. And when you're investing, you want to know that volatility is going to happen. Now, if you're the sort of investor who can, and remember, as a super fund member, you are an investor. So when I say investor, I don't necessarily even mean personal investing. I mean, if you're super balanced, if you're invested only in shares, it will fluctuate more than if you're invested in property or cash, right? That's just the reality of these things. Now, we would say that history suggests that the fluctuation, the volatility is worth enduring because the returns that come from it are, generally speaking, better than almost any asset class over almost any time frame, any long time frame anyway. So generally speaking, if you were, and you've only just started contributing to REST, so I'm gonna assume you're a young person. That may be a horrible assumption, but let's assume that's true because you've only had it since September 2015. To the extent that's true, the longer you have left in your investment life, if you can stomach the volatility, and you need to know this, right? Don't pretend you can and then freak out when it happens. So really know yourself and think to yourself, okay, is this real? Can I really, really endure that volatility? If you can, I think most people who are younger should be in higher growth investment options, right? Because there's no point being in cash earning 2% when you can invest in over many, many decades, the historical return from shares has been 10%. That's a lot to give up. And compounding, it's hugely different, right? If you earn 2%, you'll double your money every 30 or so years. If you get 10%, you'll double the money every 7 years. So it's not just an 8 percentage point difference. It seems, you know, $102 after a year, it doesn't feel like a big difference. But if you compound that for any length of time, huge, huge difference. So firstly, take as much volatility as you're comfortable with. The more the better because it gets you out of the lower returning assets. Secondly, I would say I have no view on REST Super specifically. I am happy that it's an industry fund rather than a retail fund. As I said last week, we don't have any problem with profits, but I don't like paying other people their profits. So we like our companies to make money, but not the things we actually buy off the shelf. And this is super is one of those things. Generally speaking, retail funds as a group horribly, horribly lag against industry funds. And just to define my terms here, a retail fund is a for-profit one offered normally by a bank or a financial institution. So if you think about a Colonial First State or a CBA or a, what else is out there, mate? Plenty of others anyway. If it's run by a bank or a BT, if it's run by a bank or a financial service company, they're making profit off that and they're entitled to, that's completely fine. The problem is if they do that, the money's coming out of your pocket, not theirs, right? So you're the only one who's paying the fees. So if they're making money, you're not. An industry fund is a not-for-profit fund normally set up between unions and employers, generally speaking, or industry bodies of some description or other. Some people have a political view about the union involvement. I don't really care. I'm going to stay at it altogether. The reality is they are lower fee. And over time, industry funds, the not-for-profit funds, massively, massively outperform retail funds. Right? And again, talk about the compounding. I saw some numbers that can have up to 45% difference on your super value by the time you retire, right?
That's a large number.
Well, it's kind of half, right? Mm. So, and just because the compound value of fees. So, you know, those AGSC with the kind of the cupped hands above and below, you know, I'm in industry super. Those mobs generally are better than the others. Really, with super, you just want to put your money in, get the best return you can and leave it for as long as you possibly can. So, I wouldn't worry about the performance of REST in September 2015 if you're in the right strategy. I would personally be going for as high a growth strategy as you can comfortably cope with volatility-wise in an industry fund and let them do their thing.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Now, Doc, here's one I can pronounce. It's from Baboon the Investor on Twitter.
I love the name.
Me too. So I'm happy to say this one. Baboon the Investor says, greetings, Scott and Dr. Mahanty. That's very formal. Very nice. Why didn't I get Mr. Phillips?
I don't know. I like Baboon. It's correct.
I do too. So, you know, anyway. A question from a new investor that is trying not to get lost with all the quantitative indices. Man, we'll go through it in a minute. To measure the value of a company. But a specific question, what is the reason for a company to be valued at less than NTAP? For instance, Avayo Group or MaxiTrans. Now, I don't follow Avayo closely. I don't think you do either, mate, or MaxiTrans. But if you do, feel free to comment. Generally speaking, though, so firstly, from a new investor, getting into all the quant stuff, you're not a big quant guy, I'm guessing, mate. You're not really a valuation kind of guy, are you?
Not really.
What reasons would a company trade for less than its net tangible asset? I think that's what NTAP, we normally say NTA.
The P must be per
share.
Per share or something
so.
Like that.
I think yeah. So. So let's assume it's NTA, net tangible assets. Now let's again define our terms. I like that phrase. I've got it from David Gardner. I'm a big fan of that. Mm-hmm. Let's define our terms. What is net tangible assets?
Okay. So tangible assets are assets that you can touch and feel and
cash
see.
In the bank, a bank, truck down the car park, a factory.
Assembly, plant.
Chairs and desks.
Chairs and desks, computers.
But not brand names or licenses or...
Yeah, brand names, you know, intangibles, right? So brand names,
So I know you're not this sort of investor, but why would I care about tangible assets rather than intangible assets?
Well, okay, so if... your company is being liquidated.
Yes. Why would it be liquidated?
If your company is going bankrupt.
Okay. So the business isn't making any money. The creditors say, dude, that's it, you're done. Yeah.
So the tangible assets are easier to sell. Like if there's a piece of land, or in theory, at least a piece of land, then and the company owns that piece of land, then you can sell it.
Right. Because if you've got a brand that's worth $1 million on the books, if you go broke, there's a fair chance that's not
the
worth $1 million
anymore,
right?
Yeah, so the brand is damaged.
So you might get a couple of bucks from the brand. I'm thinking about, say, Dick Smith, for example, right? Yeah. When it went broke, Kogan bought dicksmith.com.au because they wanted the domain to sell Kogan products on. So that, you know, it had a little bit of value, but not a whole heap compared to the fact they had some inventory in the warehouse and other things they could actually sell.
Exactly. So a lot in the industrial, so the way to think about it, in the industrial age, when a lot of companies basically had a lot of plants, machineries, and, you know, warehouses, godowns, and physical assets, then you could look at the net tangible asset at that time. Now, in this day and age, a lot of companies are IP companies, they're intellectual property companies, right? So they are asset light in that sense.
Right.
So if you're looking at any software company on the ASX.
Say Apple, go on.
I was going to say software company. Any software company. Right. Let's say you're looking at Appen, right?
Appen, okay.
Okay. You know, Appen does, voice transcriptions and things like that. So it's an, you know, artificial intelligence to help other companies in in contextualization of information that people are, for example, searching.
Plus, it hires some staff, but they're not on the books, so there's no assets there.
Exactly. So, you know, a lot of the stuff that they do is basically related to intellectual property and IP and processes and so on. But, it's good, you know, they probably only lease offices, right? They don't actually even own plants, machineries. They may have some chairs and tables, but it's not the same thing as having, you know, large factories spinning out cars.
So for the investor, the benefit of Appen is it doesn't cost much money to run.
Yeah.
And if you believe it's going to earn a lot of profits in the future, you don't really care about whether there's desks and chairs and factories and widgets. You just care about how well they can sell their service to somebody else.
Exactly. And being asset light is great in the sense that, you know, it requires less capital to grow and therefore it can actually potentially grow faster, right? So that's the trade-off.
But it's riskier because if it does go broke or gets into trouble, it hasn't got much to sell. So there's kind of a decent downside risk not about Apple necessarily, because we have different views on the company, but if the business got tough all of a sudden and or went broke or simply tried to raise cash, it couldn't do that easily, right?
That's right.
On the flip side, you've got, say, let's say Centre Group, who own and operate the Westfield Centres in Australia and New Zealand.
Yep.
They're pretty much all hard assets, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So the hard asset prices could fall, but there are some hard assets that, you know, you could liquidate, right? I mean, the flip side here, though, is most of the time, shareholders try to think about NTAs or net tangible assets, but we need to realize that companies that typically have a lot of hard assets also have a lot of debt, and the debt typically is held by debt holders. And then in the hierarchy of people being paid in the event of bad things happening,
yes,
shareholders are way below.
Right. So right. The debt holders get paid back first, yeah, or secure debt holders. Now, here's the thing. This is why the word net is important, because net tangible assets,
yeah,
takes all of those assets and says, let's take off the debt first,
yeah, that's right,
and
yeah,
find out what's less. So you got, yeah, you got $2 of assets per share, a dollar of debt per share.
Yeah.
So your net tangible assets, tangible again, are $1 per share.
Right.
And what Baboon's asking is, well, if you got $1 in the bank,
yeah,
why would the shares be trading for 90 cents?
Yeah, so sometimes, you know, if it's trading at 90 cents, you know, maybe sometimes it could be an indication of mispricing on the market's,
yes,
part, right?
On the other, so it could be cheap.
It could be cheap. So that's you know, like, so it's like typically how people might buy banks on a book value basis, for example, right? Below book value might look cheap. But the other thing could be that the market is actually pricing in the fact that a tangible assets are actually going to be worth less,
right,
in the future, right?
And why would that happen, Mike?
Well, property prices do fall.
You mentioned that before.
Yeah, so I mean, you know,
yeah.
So, things, property prices fall, plants and machineries and assembly plants, yep, and things like that might become useless, yep, all sorts of things, right?
I'll add a couple here. Another thing with those assets is that the book value or the recorded value in the accounts, which makes up part of the net tangible assets, are based on what they either you paid for it or what the depreciated value is. So you bought a desk for $100, you've used it for a year, you could probably sell it for $90 now, so it's worth, in theory, $90 on the books, right? And that would be part of the NTA calculation. The problem is that if you had a business go out of business, all of a sudden Dick Smith, for example, went out of business, and my local Dick Smith, you could walk in there and buy shelving, and you could buy a cash register, and you could buy their, you know, lighting, and they were literally selling everything. But I guarantee they weren't being sold for the same price they're on the books for. So the so-called fire sale value, in other words, if you sold everything because the liquidator says it's all got to go, you're not going to recover your net tangible asset value because you're recording it at a business as usual value.
Hmm.
And it's simply not worth that much if you've got to sell it in a hurry or there's an oversupply of whatever it is. The inventory they had, for example, they had a truckload of TVs. They went out of business because they couldn't sell the TVs.
Hmm.
Now they're trying to sell them cheaply. It's going to be sold at half the price or a quarter of the price they were previously.
Right.
So they're on the books at $100 for TV or $1,000. They're now selling it for $500 or $400. So you're not going to recover that NTA. The other reason I'll say is that often businesses that are likely to lose money over time or are losing money over time are also valued less, because if you've got $100 cash in the bank, but you're going to lose $50 this year, you're going to finish the year with less cash than you started with. And so the NTA being backward looking doesn't always take into account the fact that, well, things kind of can get worse, mm, right? And so you end up with less assets because you're spending money, mm, and you're making a loss. And so that NTA is going to fall over time.
That's very complicated.
It is. Generally speaking, I don't think you're an NTA kind of guy.
I don't like NTA. Any kind of investing based on NTA is not my thing. I would steer clear of it.
I would too. The only thing I would say about NTA, actually, and it's part of the steer clear question, is just be careful with things like property trusts. At the end of the day, if you're a property investor, you want to buy or sell a property for what it's worth. I mean, ideally less than it's worth. If you've got a property company, say, again, a Scentre Group selling on 1.2 times its value, book value, it's like if you went to the set, that shopping is worth $1 million, I'll pay you $1.2 million for it. You know, if the value on the books is being recorded correctly, and it should be for property companies, paying above book value is generally a really, really, really bad way to make money, unless they have some sort of profit generating machine that doesn't account for that property, right? So, because the other day, the property value is a function of its rent. If you're collecting the rent as a landlord, then you're getting that rent anyway. The property's worth what it's worth. Paying more than book value, as I said, like going to an auction and saying, well, I know the house is worth $1 million, but I'll pay 1.2 for it.
Hmm.
You'd never do that. So just be a little bit careful with NTA. It's usually not very useful for most companies these days. But for companies that have a lot of hard assets, for financial companies and for property companies, it's a really, really important metric.
For property companies, aren't those revised every couple of years, a few years, the book value?
So it's every year part of the portfolio is revalued.
Revalued.
So I think it's every 4 or 5 years on a rotating basis. So effectively 25 or 20% of that per year is revalued. Again, now that's based on the current valuation. So as you said, with property prices falling, if you're buying into a home builder that had a lot of inventory on the books, you can assume that possibly the inventory they're trying to sell is actually worth less than what they've got on the books.
Because only 25% would have been revalued this year and the rest 75% would be revalued next year. Is that the sort of logic? Or
Over 3 or 4 years. Directors are supposed to take that into account. So if you knew that the prices were moving meaningfully, the director's obligations should be, and the auditor should make them, revalue the whole lot. So if I was an auditor of a company that held a lot of residential property, for example, mm-hmm. I'd be saying, I'm not going to sign off your books if you're going to only revalue a quarter of it, because we both know that if a quarter of it's fallen in value, the other three quarters has as
exactly.
well. So they should, directors are responsible for representing the accounts in a true and fair manner. They should revalue the lot. They possibly don't, so just be a little bit careful.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, on to another question. We've got a question from Simon. Simon lives in Tokyo.
Hey, that's
which I think
nice.
So far is our furthest away listener, or am I right, or at least correspondent?
Probably.
If you're further away from Sydney than Tokyo, please get in touch with us. Hit us up on the socials or via email. I'll give you those details in a minute. Jump online and let us know where you're listening from. That'll be just kind of fun. We'll put up a virtual pin board and we'll try and work out who's furthest away, just for the fun of it. So Simon says, hi, guys. Love the podcast. Hey.
He knows what to do.
He's been listening. I listen every Friday from Tokyo, Japan. My question is for Doc.
No, this question's for me.
Should we move on?
Don't go to the question.
All right.
I already like Simon.
I like Simon a little bit less. I used to like Simon more.
I think Simon is a great guy.
Yeah. We love you, Simon. Can you please explain to me how you make money from growth stocks that don't pay a dividend? It's nice to see when share prices go up, but unless you actually sell some of your shares, isn't that profit just a number on a computer screen? Do you sell some shares while retaining some in case the price goes up further? If so, when and how do you approach this? So they've gone into it another company, but let's just stop there for a second. Mm-hmm. So if I'm an investor in Telstra, which I happen to be, full disclosure, I own the shares, I'm going to get paid. In fact, the Telstra dividend arrived the other day, which is kind of nice. Got my Coke dividend too the other day.
Oh.
That was good. I'm unfortunately both losing money on both shares, so that's probably part of your answer. Mm-hmm. if I'm a Telstra shareholder, I've got the shares. I can hold them effectively indefinitely. The company's going to throw me some money every 6 months, assuming it still remains profitable, which I'm going to assume it will. So I get some. That's how I make my money from Telstra shares, right? If I hold them, I don't sell them. I'm richer because I've sold them. I can spend that money. I can reinvest that money. I can do whatever I want. That sounds like fun. I also own Berkshire Hathaway shares, and so far I'm no richer, at least in any physical way, for owning Berkshire Hathaway because I've never paid me a dividend. Am I a mug for holding Berkshire Hathaway or am I a mug for holding Telstra and why?
You know the answer to that one.
I'm setting you up, mate. So, I'm a nice bloke.
So
I'm the straight man here, right?
So I'm not going to embarrass you further. And I'm going to go and answer. So I think here's a common fallacy. The common fallacy is that there's something people think about house money. So I'll explain that.
Yes.
So let's say you invest $1,000 in a company.
Yes.
People think of that. That's house money, right? Mm-hmm. In the gambling term.
Yep.
And now that company has, say, become worth $2,000.
Right.
Then they think that, okay, what I can do is I can take back my house money, $1,000, yep. and then leave the other $1,000.
Right. Because I haven't lost any money then.
But then you have not. Then you can never lose money. But here's the deal: the $1,000 was your money,
yep.
and the $2,000 too is your money. Effectively, any gains from the shares are your money.
Right.
So if you buy growth stocks and they go up,
yes.
like you know, or Berkshire Hathaway is not quite the growth stock, but it does go up or has gone up in the past. So therefore, if you had invested $1,000 in Berkshire and today it is, let's say, $2,000. You actually have gain on that. It's just the same thing as, effectively the same thing as getting a dividend. It's just another way of getting gains in the market.
Okay,
right?
but that gain's not real until I sell, right? So aren't I going to be a bit concerned that, well, if my $2,000 turns into $1,000 before I have a chance to sell the shares, then I might end up making nothing at all?
That is correct, but at the same time, you could have bought Telstra at $6, and today it is
kind,
at today is at $2.50.
$3.20 at least,
okay,
dude. Come on,
let's for the sake of maths, let's say that you bought at $5, and then today it is $2.50.
You're making
maybe 8% on dividend, but your share price is actually halved. So if you put $1,000, it's actually $500 now.
That's a lot of 8% I need.
You need a lot of 8% to actually make up. So it's just another form. The gains to be looked at are a combination of both the capital appreciation and the dividends, and it's the combination of both that you should look at. If you are an investor that needs income, you can actually generate income out of growth stocks by just selling some periodically too, you know, maybe proportionally or maybe to reweight your portfolio, however you want to do it, but you can actually get an income out of it. Just, it's the same thing. I think, you know, people should not be hell-bent on thinking that I want only dividend-paying stocks to get
income. I think that basically narrows your spectrum of opportunity, and narrowing your spectrum of opportunity basically, I think, is not a good idea. So that's number one. The number two is that if you don't need that money and you think your company is going to continue compounding, well, you can just let it compound as long as you're happy with the allocation and you can sleep at night and you can tolerate the volatility that comes with maybe growth stocks. Then, you know, there are stocks that I have owned since maybe 2011, 2012 mm-hmm. that I haven't sold, you know, and they have compounded over time, and that's fine.
I think it's a good point. So, look, I'll add a little bit, if you don't mind, Doc, to your sure. wonderful answer. Look, Simon, here's the thing. If you need the money regularly, then as Doc said, you can sell some shares to receive some cash, right? At the end of the day, a dividend is money the company's paying to you rather than reinvesting in its own growth. And over time, Warren Buffett's, I used to work Berkshire Hathaway deliberately. Not only do I own it, but Warren Buffett's also talked about this in the past where someone says, hey, pay us a dividend, pay us a dividend. Now, he said that historically, and it's true, historically at least, money left in the company is worth much more to current shareholders than money paid as a dividend. If he'd paid a dividend every year since 1965, Berkshire shareholders would be much, 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 much worse off because he's returned more by reinvesting that money into new business opportunities than if he paid it in a dividend. And so his point is if you'd have wanted dividends the whole way through or you wanted some cash, you could have simply sold off a chunk. If you want a 5% dividend, sell 5% of your shares or whatever the numbers add up to every year, take your money out of the company and let the rest ride to basically compound at a fast rate. If it's a growing company, it should compound at that kind of rate. You know, the likes of Amazon's an easy example. Apple, you can probably tell me about too, Doc. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but where an Amazon's gone from, you know, effectively $9 to 90 to 3 to 2,000 or close enough to, over that time, you know, they couldn't have paid a dividend, but the value created is every bit as real as if they'd paid money out along the way. So if you need the cash, then by all means, sell a bit and take some money out. If you're on a winner with the company, you're much better doing that than investing in a lower growth. And I'll throw myself under a bus here with Telstra. I would have been much better buying more Amazon, less Telstra, even though one paid a dividend and one didn't, because I'd be worth much more on paper. And if I wanted the cash, I could have sold some Amazon shares and still done much, much better than if I'd bought Telstra shares and claimed what in theory was a higher income payment. Now, if you're not looking at the income right now, you'd in theory be reinvesting that money anyway, right? So to some degree, a company not paying a dividend is simply reinvesting that money on your behalf. So in the context of the way that works, if you know the company's worth $100, $100 a share, it pays you a $10 dividend. So the share price falls to $90. You take your $10, you can buy more Telstra again for this example. Then you've got $100 worth of Telstra again, and it's got to keep growing on its merry way. So to some degree, it can pay you out, and you can reinvest that money, or it can simply retain that cash, reinvest in itself, and grow accordingly. And in theory, that will give you the same or a better return than actually paying tax on the dividend and then reinvesting the money anyway. So look, I'm completely agnostic. My view is, and we've always said, so for our services, for example, Share Advisor that I run, probably more than half the companies pay a dividend, but certainly not all. And the dividend just changed very dramatically from less than 1% to 8 or so, I think it probably is Telstra Doc. The reality is I don't really care how the return comes, right? All I care about is maximizing the total return, whether it's half dividend, half capital growth, all dividends, anywhere in between, doesn't matter. Our job is to beat the market because you can always sell those shares at some future time. And as long as the company is generating real value, now, if the share price is going up because it's momentum and people are getting carried away, that's a whole different question, right, about valuation. But as a shareholder, I don't care whether they pay me a dividend or don't. What I care about is am I beating the market in a total return sense, which adds together capital growth and that dividend to try and maximize my total return.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Doc, we have a question from Ashish about a company that's a recommendation of ours at Share Advisor, full disclosure. He says, hey guys, love the podcast. Hey. Will I rant about this or not, do you think?
Well, he'd love the podcast.
No, the next bit.
What
do you think I'm going to rant about?
You can
about rant. People using tickers rather than company names.
Oh.
Yeah, it drives me mad.
Ashish, give it a pass this time.
Do you think? Can I, a little bit of a rant? Can I at least talk about it?
He says, okay, sure. Yeah, but he loves us,
off mic, because yes, I can talk about it. So I'm going to. Here's the thing, fools. This is not about a shish at all. This is completely usual, regular. People talk about stocks by using the tickers. I don't even like calling them stocks, frankly. I'd rather call them companies. Anything that separates us from the business of business is a problem in my mind. People talk about stocks by using three-letter tickers, CGF in this case, which is Challenger Financial, an annuities and fund management company. When you talk about CGF or TLS or WOW for Woolies or BHP for BHP. Okay, bad example. When you use the tickers only, I think it starts to mentally divorce us from the reality of investing. Now, some people will say, yeah, we know that, Scott. We're clever enough. We're big enough. We're adult enough to know that a ticker is a company. A company is a ticker. So just back off. I get that. But if you know anything about behavioral finance, you will know that our brains take shortcuts wherever they can. And as soon as you start doing that, your brain will start to think less about the company and more about the ticker, even subconsciously, right? So if you know anything about behavioral finance, you know you can't change that. You can't get around it. It is what it is, no matter how smart or capable or thoughtful you think you are. So as a matter of course, those pre-commitment devices that we like to call them, if we always talk about companies rather than tickers, we are much, much, much more likely to stop falling in the traps of thinking about them as tickers on a screen and charts and movements and all that kind of stuff and think about real businesses. That wasn't too bad, was it, Doc?
No, you got to rant.
It wasn't even a major rant. Like, I didn't really get really worked up.
That's true.
Ashish, so you ask about Challenger Financial. I'll edit for you. That way we'll both be happy. Love the podcast. Is Challenger Financial still a good buy? Your recommendation December 18 around $9, now trading around $7.
Now I know why you were ranting. Eh?
just trying to cover up.
Your recommendation hasn't gone up. It's all your fault.
It is my fault. Sorry, Ashish. Look, so do you have a view on Challenger, Doc, before I answer?
No. I don't. I know it's a good company. Actually, I had some view, but I think, you know, it's a slow and steady company.
All right. So Challenger Financial does something that most companies don't do, at least at scale in Australia, which is selling a product called an annuity. An annuity basically lets retirees normally, in particular, or people who are just looking to make income from their portfolios, exchange their cash for a regular flow of income. If that sounds like dividends to you, it's kind of that, except you actually don't own the underlying cash anymore. You'd hand it over in most cases. Some of the policies are a little bit different depending on the policy. Generally speaking, you say, look, I'm going to give you all my money. And in return, the company says, I will give you a guaranteed amount. They calculate it as a percentage, but they pay it as a dollar amount. So let's say you give them $1 million. They promise to give you 40 grand a year in return. That's a 4% return. It won't fluctuate with the market. You won't have to worry about the capital value moving around. The dividends can't go up and down. You don't have to worry about the Alan Kohler on the 7 News talking about the movements in share prices. You can just say, I don't care what happens there. I'm getting my money every day, all day. It's going to come in every month, reliably, regularly. That's good enough for me. Now, I happen to think that's a suboptimal investment strategy, by the way, but for some people, that's what they want. That's what makes them feel good. That's what helps them sleep at night. And frankly, if you've worked for 45 years, you deserve to sleep at night. So if that's the thing you need to do as an investor, then great. That's what Challenger's there for. The pool of annuities is growing dramatically and will continue to in Australia because there's more money going into super, more money going to come out of super over the next 20 or 30 years. And I think the investment opportunity for Challenger relies basically on that. I think it's the leader by a long, long, long way in annuity sales. And I think that will continue to happen. It's an investment. It's a life insurance policy for what it's worth. That's one of the technicalities. Not a financial product. It's not a fund or investment as such. It's a financial product in the sense it's a life insurance policy, of course. But they will pay you out for the rest of your life at an agreed amount. And as long as they don't go broke, which is a risk, but very, very small one, then you will receive your annuity from now until effectively the last breath you take. Now, that's a really good policy. I like the company a lot for that reason. I think there's going to be a growing amount of annuities being sold. The company clips the ticket. They effectively make a margin on the difference. They insure the volatility, if you like, in the financial parlance. So if the market returns an average of 7% and they pay you 4%, they get to take the 3%. So that's why they do it. That's what's in it for them. What's in it for the customers is that lack of volatility. Some days the market's down 3%, by the way. They still get paid out their 4%. So they make a loss in that year on that annuity. And that's exactly why the company exists, to smooth out that volatility for people, and it takes its premium on the way through. So I expect the pool of annuities to continue growing pretty meaningfully. Australia already has the fourth largest pensions market in the world, and annuities haven't traditionally been very tax advantaged. That's going to change probably from next year under the current legislation, which I don't think either party is going to change. So in any case, I think that's a really good long-term trend for Challenger. This is a 10-year plus investment strategy or investment thesis for me. I still like it. Yes, the price has fallen. It's fallen because it had a reasonably ordinary year last year. Because frankly, it didn't get the investment profit it had the year before. So profits fell. The market was pretty unimpressed. The shares fell. That's going to happen. But I think overall, that's still a very, very good and solid investment idea. It's one of my recommendations, a buy recommendation at ShareAdvisor. It's a company I'd be more than happy to hold for the next decade or more.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
I'm going to ask you a question.
Ask me.
You've seen the next question on our list, haven't you?
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to take a guess that you're going to be better able to pronounce that name than I am. And again, I mean no disrespect to the correspondent. I'm going to horribly hash it. I would absolutely have a go and have an authentic, genuine go at it if I was here by myself. But I'm not, and you are. And being at least Indian by birth and by family background, I reckon you've probably got a better chance of pronouncing, if I can say pronouncing properly, pronouncing this than I have. What do you reckon?
I think so. Sounds a good day, Priyanshu.
There you go. Priyanshu.
Priyanshu. Bhardwaj.
Bhardwaj. How'd it go?
Pretty good. Scott.
Priyanshu Bhardwaj.
Yeah, you can actually travel to India and, you know, actually speak to people.
Well, if I meet Priyanshu, I can. If I meet anybody else, I'm stuffed.
You're stuffed.
Again, I do apologize. I mean, absolutely no disrespect. Lovely work on the podcast. It's been such a massive learning. Could you please tell me about the sources where we can apply for IPOs that are going to get listed in the US from Australia? So if you're in Australia, you invest in a US IPO, and Priyanshu gives the examples of Zoom, Uber, and Pinterest, and others. Thanks. Now, mate, I do a little bit of investing in the US, but I'm relatively hands-off there. My largest holding is Berkshire Hathaway, as I've said many times, but I don't do a lot of back and forth, and I certainly don't invest in IPOs. You're kind of closer to the IPO end of the market. You like growth companies, and you're more likely to invest in some of those, so you know more than I do on this one. How can an Australian investor get their hands on an IPO?
Okay. So if the question is, if you want to invest before the company goes IPO or at the IPO pricing?
If you want shares in the IPO itself, you want to buy shares that you buy before the company goes live, how do you do that?
I guess the only way to do that might be that you are with an investment bank that is actually going to deliver those IPO shares, and therefore you can apply for some.
Which is relatively unlikely.
It's relatively unlikely. I don't want to make any guesses about, you know, maybe Priyanshu has got accounts with Morgan Stanley and therefore can.
But even then, you've got to kind of be a preferred client, right?
If you're a preferred client of Morgan Stanley, maybe you can get shares at IPO. Otherwise, you can get shares only when the company trades. That's number one. The couple of things I'll add. You can indirectly get exposure to some of these companies a priori to them IPOing through other public companies. So, for example,
tell me how.
So again, and this is not, you can't really size things here. So, for example, if you look at the big Chinese company called Tencent, it's a large conglomerate in some sense of China. It's a large internet company of China, but they have a lot of investments in pre-IPO companies. Mm-hmm. So you could get an exposure by buying shares in those companies, and eventually, you know, one would think that maybe Tencent is going to sell their share in, say, Airbnb when Airbnb floats or at some point, right? Mm-hmm. So there'll be an exit clause that says that they can exit at some point.
Okay.
So that's one way to get exposure.
So kind of indirect exposure.
Indirect exposure.
Okay.
The other, you know, if you're interested in really pre-IPO companies, there are now, previously you couldn't as individual investor invest in very risky private companies. Now those rules have been lightened, and there are places like what one is called Seed Invest, for example, where you can read prospectus of various companies from somebody's cool idea to something really significant to maybe burgers. You know, if somebody has a burger joint that's going national to
Doc's Burgers. I like it.
All these, you know, new things have come out about, you know, the meatless meat stuff. You can invest in those sort of ideas through Seed Invest. I would say that I have an account with Seed Invest, but I've never invested because I never got around to actually reading the prospectus, and the one instance where I read something, there were so many clauses that I couldn't get, you know, it really required you to read many times. So, I mean, it's possible, but it's hard, very hard, because most of these companies are owned by VC firms, you know, VC firms, and have large stakes in it. And it's essentially when they're coming public, at some point, the VC funds are going to exit.
And they're not really in the business of giving us retail investors an even shake, are they?
No. So the VC funds, and the general trend has been for VC funds to actually own these. So VC and venture capitals have been owning and holding on to these companies for a long, long time before they're actually bringing these companies into the public market. Uber is apparently going to come at $100 billion-plus valuation, right?
Pocket change.
A pocket change.
Split it. You want to go halves.
Yeah, exactly. It's hard.
Great question. Look, I will say, Priyanshu, I'll add a couple of thoughts. Just the first thing I guess I'd add is, to Doc's point, they've loosened the regulations. We're all for investor access at the Motley Fool. I have to say, on a personal level, I kind of get nervous anytime that happens. The fact there are regulations is designed to protect retail investors from, you know, the original idea, they're called sophisticated investors, right? Well, those people who could do it without a prospectus, without a lot of detail, take some more risk. Now, we all kind of want to be risk, you know, tolerant or even risk-seeking potentially sometimes. But at some level, the fact there is less disclosure pre-IPO can be both a blessing and a curse. Mm-hmm. So just be a little bit careful there. Of course, we also know that, like Most VC firms will say they get about 1 in 20 right. So unless you're going to buy a whole lot of them, looking at just one company hoping to make money in that pre-IPO market can be a bit of a, you know, a bit of a crapshoot. You might do okay, you might do terribly, and frankly, if you had three or four of them, there's every chance you might lose in all of them. Even if one of the 20 still wins, the chance of you getting that one out of that 20 is pretty light. I will say too, for what it's worth, it's always tempting to get in pre-IPO, right? Because we all hear that kind of the term stag profit, the idea of the day one profit. If I can buy at 100, list 150, then I'm all of a sudden a squillionaire. That's pretty enticing. I will say, for what it's worth, think about the likes of, say, a Facebook or a Google or an Amazon, or Doc, you might be throwing me a couple other ideas. Companies that listed and they've gone on to bigger and better things post-listing, right? So the money on a really high-quality company that IPOs is very rarely all made on day one. So yes, you know, be nice to make money before that. Frankly, though, if you buy a pre-IPO company and lose money, you're worse off than if you waited for a Google to go public, just to pick an example, and bought it on day one or day two or day seven or day 25 or day 400. You still made a heap of money, right, relative to...
You'd be just better off buying Apple, though.
Or Apple, exactly. Yeah. Apple's a long time ago.
Yeah, So the day Google came out, and if you bought Apple shares that day, you'd still be way ahead. It's a small, small fact. I think it's worth pointing out. I had to throw you off your... track here. But I think it is very... I think it is seductive to think and, you know, invest in... Actually, it's even risky to actually invest right after a company comes into the market, yeah, right? Because, correct, you know, there's a lot of exuberance. The share prices either go up a lot or go down a lot.
Yep.
Right.
I'll take Maya, right? Maya listed and then went nowhere but down after that.
Yeah. So a lot of things happen. But the other thing to remember is that, you know, if you just think of the ASX, ASX got like, 1,700 companies, right? If you go to the NASDAQ and NYSE, you've got another like 6,000. If you think of the world's companies, you've got probably like 15,000 companies that you can invest in.
Yeah.
And people can make, as you said, you know, you could invest in Amazon and make, you know, squillion bucks in the public market. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe watching for the financials and seeing, you know, having good exposure to the financials, seeing what the company is doing is, there are ways to make money and maybe more safer, better,
yeah,
and less risky.
Well, I think that is the good point, right? I mean, I know you're kidding about Apple, but at some level, that's kind of the point. So, you know, investing in Google IPO, if you were going to make more money out of Apple, now, you had to know that in advance, and maybe you didn't, and both have done very well, by the way, but to some degree, you know, desperately waiting for the IPO or trying to invest pre-IPO Google or whatever,
yeah,
there were actually much better opportunities on the market already anyway.
Exactly.
So don't just get fixated on the IPOs in themselves. They kind of feel like these lottery ticket ideas that you want to be part of.
Yeah.
They don't always necessarily give you the best possible.
And there's a lot of buzz, right? The buzz is created by the newspapers, the Twitters, and the, you know, everything. People, there's a lot of buzz and
FOMO,
excitement.
Dude, FOMO,
there's
a lot of FOMO. Yeah. Fear of missing out.
Yeah.
Mate, that almost wraps us up. Before we go, though, I am going to share our social contacts. If you want to get in touch with us, please email us at info@fool.com.au. You can get us on Twitter @TheMotleyFoolAU or get us on Facebook, The Motley Fool Australia. We're all those platforms. Twitter's the most fun because we get to kind of chat back and forth. Not everyone's on Twitter, though. So if you're not on Twitter, feel free to email us or hit us up, as I said, on Facebook. We love hearing from you. Give us your comments, your suggestions, your questions. Most importantly, let us know what we're doing right and wrong and what you want to hear more or less of. As I say regularly, this is your podcast. We do it for the love of it, quite frankly. You're not paying anything for it. At least if you are, you're paying the wrong people. And if you want to send us cash, feel free. But other than that, we hope you're enjoying it. So please let us know what will make it better for you. And Doc, as I always say, you can subscribe to the MMM Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a 5-star rating, give us a review. As David Gardner would say, as I quoted a couple of times, throw us some stars. I'll steal his stuff because it's pretty good. Mm-hmm. Because the more people know about the podcast, hopefully, the more Australians are investing better, and that's why we're here. And of course, you can get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox by going to fool.com.au/MMM. MMM. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week after Easter with another dose of foolish insight. Happy Easter and fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.